time to go to Hannah Scott. Tens of thousands of cases backlogged in King County Superior Court after the pandemic shut down the courts for months. And today, the King County Council will vote on appropriating enough money to address this problem. Here's Kyrita's Hannah Scott to explain where it stands. Hannah.
Good morning, Dave. Yeah, we're talking about more than $31 million to address this massive, massive backlogs in the courts, both municipal, county, everything that's just been so backed up during the shutdown when all of the court proceedings were put on hold. And so that 55,000 number covers your criminal, civil, all of the different kinds of cases that have just been sitting there on hold. Now, things have been back up and running for some time, but you've heard from the presiding judge at King County Superior Court and from our county prosecutor, they need more resources because they were behind to begin with before the pandemic even started. And now it's just been exacerbated. So today, this is the latest time that they're going to do a supplemental budget vote at the King County Council, and it involves some of the COVID dollars that we got from the federal government. And Dan Satterberg, our county prosecutor, as well as the judges over there at Superior Court, had asked, put in this request, kind of laid it out for the County Council a few months ago to say, this is where we're at, and this is a very significant problem. Now, that's especially true for Dan Satterberg in the prosecutor's office, who had 7,000 cases still to deal with, and then there's 3,000 cases that they haven't even looked at, and those are violent crimes we're talking about, right? So murders and 200 murder cases that haven't been dealt with, and then other types of violent crimes. So he's asking for a significant amount of money that will be used for to hire some more deputy prosecutors and kind of get through that. He told me the other day he thinks if he gets this money, it's going to take maybe up to 3 years to clear that backlog. Yeah, so significant time. But what we know is that this is going to be $31 million. That's what the vote is on. And when the list of where the money is came out, the presiding judge, Jim Rogers, spoke to Cairo 7 TV, and he was just shocked that the court was getting such a small chunk of this. This is, I think they're getting just under $4 million, the actual King County Superior Court. And he was stunned. He said he thought it was a typo. He said it's nowhere near enough for the court. So the other part of that $31 million is going to go to the prosecutor, which is, I believe, a little over 10 or so million, and then the rest to the public defenders, but not enough for the courts.
Wasn't this part of the federal funding that was sent to states to help them during the pandemic?
Yes, but that's not specific to the courts, right? So the King, same with Seattle and King County Council, they all have their, they have to do it like any other budget. They have to, they all kind of want a certain things, and they have to whittle it down to see what they're going to do with each thing.
And were they able to use the slack time to get any work done, either via Zoom or some other way?
The courts? So, yeah, I know the King County Superior Courts were definitely doing some things by Zoom, and I know Dan Satterberg was doing certain things by Zoom. I believe that when you're talking about violent criminal trials, those things were preferably, I think they tried to avoid that. Most courts tried to avoid that because there could open the door for possible appeal arguments.
Appeals, right.
So they didn't do a lot of that. But, you know, now they're, for the moment, at least back up and running and able to do this, but he doesn't have the staff. So, because you have to remember, before the pandemic, the law enforcement, the sheriff's office, the prosecutor's office have been underfunded for many years. So this is a really difficult situation. In fact, Dan Satterberg told me, he said, 36 years, I think, he's been somehow affiliated with the prosecutor's office there. He said this is the most concerning thing he's seen.
Okay, now I assume that the defendants who couldn't get their trials through no fault of their own had to be released, right?
For the most part, yes. I believe there was some ways to hold or do some home monitoring kind of things with when we're talking about seriously, you know, violent offenders, so that there was no community risk, that kind of thing. But yes,
right.
Otherwise,
well, I mean,
yes.
It strikes me as an interesting social experiment, right? I mean, one of the reasons you hold on to people is because you assume that they're going to reoffend if you let them out on bail, et cetera, et cetera. So do we know whether there was an uptick in crime because they had to release so many defendants who couldn't be tried?
Not that I've heard, and I think anybody that was released, especially in the prosecutor's office purview, would have been the more violent people who were kept on home monitoring or for some other reason were allowed to be kept behind bars. He was not about to let people who could be a threat to the public out. Because, you know, the King County Prosecutor's Office is always a big fan of diversion when it can be used. he made very clear to the county council, because he was asked when he presented asking for this money, that these are the violent criminals who are likely not most of them going to be, you know, qualify for diversion. Yeah, so, right. Yeah, not letting a lot of them out.
Kyle Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Choke points. It is one of Chris's top five worst merges and choke points in this region. The 167 to 405 merge in Renton. We will all be stuck in it sooner or later. Well, a new ramp meter went active this morning to try and space out cars a little better, and Chris is going to tell us how it's working.
Well, right now, not so great, because it looks like as soon as it went active, someone didn't realize that you had to have a stop there, and we have a rear-end crash they went active about 35 minutes ago, so not exactly off to the greatest of starts, but that is one of the worst spots to merge in the state. And so what we've had a couple years ago is the state added a direct HOV connection there, you know, which is part of the entire express toll lane, hot lane project, but they haven't really done anything for the solo drivers until now, which is the state adding those new ramp meters, which again went active 35 minutes ago, located right where 167 joins 405. They're going to be active from 6 a.m. to noon every weekday and afternoons when necessary.
We don't want drivers to hit a dead stop, and especially don't want them to have to get into a situation where there's some sort of a collision. So that's what this is really going to improve, and this is going to help, is making sure that there's that free flow of traffic.
The Washington Department of Transportation's Jordan Longacre says they beefed up the shoulder, and that shoulder will now be used as an additional lane on the ramp when the ramp meters are activated. That'll give drivers more than 1,200 extra feet of space to line up.
I think that will be maybe the biggest change for people, is to suddenly realize there's now two lanes for them to enter from 167 onto 405.
So here's what drivers will see. They will exit like normal in a single lane, but shortly after that, the shoulder lane on the right will open up. Drivers can use either lane when the ramp meters are active. There will be a sign letting them know if they're active or not.
They catch them by surprise at first when they notice a car zipping by them on the right-hand side. But I think once they recognize, oh, this is actually going to improve our traffic flow and there's less backup happening on 167 as a result, they'll see the benefit of that and realize that it's really a positive change.
And it's a good thing that that shoulder lane is open right now because of that crash at the ramp meter. That's the only lane where people are getting by right now. And this comes as travel on the corridor is back to pre-COVID levels.
Traffic on 167 is exceeding, you know, those pre-pandemic averages. And on 405, we're seeing it within a 10% range of those pre-pandemic averages.
WashDOT says drivers usually spend 3 to 8 minutes stuck on this ramp every morning. With those delays, those delay numbers probably won't change much with the addition of these ramp meters, but you will really notice is that 405 northbound lanes will open up a little bit because there's going to be a little bit more room to merge, and that will mean that the merging should be easier and safer. But again, looks like someone was caught off guard this morning that they had to come to a stop at the red light, and we have a rear-end crash right where these ramp meters went active. So opening day jitters for the ramp meters there at this location.
Well, the twin lane, twin traffic lights are like a forced zipper merge, essentially, right, to get down
pretty much, yeah. Yeah, we've seen where we've added these, say, on Mercer Street, trying to get onto I-5, right. And a lot of different places where you've got little extra queuing room there, which kind of hopefully eases things on both ends of the road. But it went active and caught someone off guard this morning. But yeah, it kind of forces you to zipper and kind of gives spaces out the cars, which means there's more room to merge, which means the 405 drive should move a little better once we get this car out of the way.
Dave Ross with Heather Bosch and Chris Sullivan. It's been an especially violent few days in and around the city of Seattle. Mayor and the police chief addressed this spike in gun violence yesterday, and let's go to Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott to find out what they're going to do about it. Hannah.
Yeah, absolutely. The mayor and the police chief making clear that it's time for something to change.
This past weekend, as people were coming back to Seattle, and Seattle was enjoying its nightlife, Seattle saw one of the worst late night, early morning of violence in recent memory. Over the weekend, we had several separate and unrelated incidents that erupted into gunfire that killed 5 people and injured 9 people.
And the mayor noticing that those were separate and unrelated, so a very, very big deal. And she acknowledged that the struggles in responding to some of these calls.
We saw this weekend street racing, nightlife-related altercations, firearm incidents, other life-threatening emergencies that require the response of an armed police officer. SPD officers and first responders quickly responded to secure separate scenes in different parts of our city and provide aid over this weekend. When people called 911 across the city this weekend, they expected a fast response. But nearly every officer in our city aided in the response to the incidents we saw while continuing to address urgent 911 calls.
The mayor made clear her commitment to reimagining public safety.
Even as we look to ramp up alternatives to sworn officers' response and prevention, this past weekend serves as a reminder. There are many times and types of 911 calls that require a traditional sworn police officer to respond.
So something has to change, she says.
But as a city, we cannot continue on this current trajectory of losing police officers like we have this year into the next years. Over the past 17 months, the Seattle Police Department has lost 250 police officers, which is the equivalent of over 300,000 service hours. We're on path to losing 300 officers. We are creating meaningful alternatives, but as I said last year, the city has an obligation to still continue constitutional policing and respond to 911 calls.
Chief Diaz laid things out from his perspective.
We've seen more than a 40% increase in shots fired this year compared to the same time last year. And we've seen more than 100% increase in drive-by shootings year over year. And this year alone, we've recovered close to 2,000 shell casings. Even with diminished police resources, our officers have been exhaustively working every gun violence incident because every shot fired by a criminal with a weapon is an attack against our entire community. And we do have diminished resources.
And he didn't mince any words. He said he needs more cops.
I have 115 fewer officers in patrol than I did just did a year ago. I have 38 fewer detectives to follow up on reported crime. And as the mayor said, we've almost been losing over 300 officers over the last 2 years. This is forcing tough choices. And I'm down a remarkable number of officers and I have a reduced and restricted budget. I'm having to make tough choices where essentially my hands are tied between having enough officers respond to multiple scenes of violence across the city and having officers staff special events and other low priority events.
And he says that's no choice to make. So it's obviously that he's going to have them be ready to take those priority calls. The other thing the chief said he needs.
In August, I will send down an ordinance to city council to promote more alternatives to 911 calls and address the urgent staffing crisis, including options to recruit qualified police officers quickly, to ensure that SPD has adequate staffing levels to keep our community safe at the agreed upon staffing levels in the 2021 budget. It is a false choice between community-led solutions and police officers. We need both, and we need a plan to stand up those alternatives in a way that they can deliver on what communities need.
And that's the mayor's plan. Here's what the chief needs.
We need to make sure that we're getting these guns out of the hands of people wanting to do harm. We need legal gun owners to keep their firearms locked up and safe so they can't be stolen and used to commit dangerous criminal acts. We need to put everyone, we need everyone to encourage friends and family to put down their weapons and find ways, other ways to address concerns and resolve their issues. Make no mistake, this is a gun violence crisis.
And the chief said, he pointed out that these shootings took place all over from Roosevelt to Chinatown International District, various different neighborhoods over the weekend, and that this is everyone's problem. The mayor echoing that.
This level of gun violence is unacceptable. We need everybody in the fight, and I need city council standing up and saying that the community should not have this level of violence, and we will work to make sure that we not just build up the community resilience needed, but we also make sure that when people call 911, if and when you need a police officer, one can respond.
We didn't hear a lot from City Council yesterday, except for Public Safety Chair Lisa Herbold did say, you know, we had the mayor announcing that a little over $2 million that was going to be invested in the Regional Peacekeepers Collective that King County has going. That's community passageways, Choose 180, those types of programs to help interrupt that gun violence when we're talking about young people involved. And Lisa Herbold mentioned that she's going to have an amendment soon to try to get some of that money moving a little bit faster.
Yeah. Well, the reason people have guns is because of shootings like this. They're protecting mm-hmm. themselves, and the police are not going to get there. I'm curious, anybody at the city council still talking about defunding police?
They've already agreed on that, right? So that, you know, certainly Sean Massa.
And they're sticking with that? They're sticking with that, huh?
But it's not at all what it was originally proposed to be. So they, first of all, have to stay within a certain level of staffing because of the consent decree. So that's all kind of different. They keep everything very strict on the overtime and all of those types of things. And they don't really like the idea of giving the SPD any more officers or things of like that. But the chief says he needs them. The mayor says that they need them. But she also said that we'll do this at the agreed upon 2021 budget staffing levels that we agreed on.
What does that mean? Yeah. Do they have the money for these 250 officers who they have to replace or not?
Well, they do. Yeah, I do believe they do actually they do. Have that money. But I think the problem is they don't have the officers.
Well, that's the other thing. Where do you find now? The chief implied that there is a way of getting officers quickly. What would that be?
They didn't elaborate on that, but the mayor definitely said that there was going to be an effort to quickly get new officers and make sure that they're retaining the ones that they do have. And I think that has to do with making sure that they know that they have the support. I think you'll hear some urging to have the city council show some support for the law enforcement to make sure that they can retain these folks. So we'll have to see how it plays out.
What about taking pressure off 911? Is there that alternative yet to calling 911 for people who do not need necessarily a police officer to respond?
So we have this announcement, one of several announcements that we've heard from the mayor this week and last week is there's going to be something possibly called Triage One, which will look like what you're talking about, where mm-hmm. you've got these trained professionals who take these calls and figure out whether that needs a law enforcement or somebody else, a mental health worker or something like that to respond. It's not, we don't have it up yet. It's not running yet.
It's not there.
And there's also some other proposals that are alternatives to police answering 911 calls that are going to be discussed as part of a separate proposal that is being report, that's being laid out in the city council later today. I expect you'll see a lot of activity and discussion about this. There is a lot of support for those efforts on the city council, I should say.
Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. Thanks, Hannah.
You bet.
When a woman was jogging with her dog past a funeral home, a 6-year-old proudly asked her if she'd like to meet her dad, who was lying inside. Unsure, the woman followed her gut and followed the little girl down the aisle. CBS's Steve Hartman with your daily dose of kindness brought to you by Heritage Homecraft.
Yay! According to her mother, Lacey, 6-year-old Raylin Nast of Fort Smith, Arkansas, has always been a daddy's girl.
She was very proud of her dad. She always wanted to introduce her dad to just about anybody.
Until recently, when her father, Davy, died of colon cancer. He was just 41, and Raylin was just devastated.
It was a cry that was pure heartbreak.
Enter Emily Beineman, who happened to be jogging with her dog, Blue, the day of the visitation. She was running past the funeral home when all of a sudden she heard a tiny voice call out from the chapel steps.
She's like, "May I pet your puppy?" And I was like, "Yeah, like of course, like as long as your parents don't mind."
That's what you said to her?
Yeah.
Not knowing,
yeah.
Raylin explained that her dad was lying inside, gave Blue a huge hug, and then gave Emily a stunning invitation.
I asked her if she wanted to come in and see my dad.
That's right. This still proud daughter invited that random jogger to meet her father.
Emily was hardly dressed for a funeral, and she knew just walking in the door would cause a scene. But she also knew this was the last time that little girl would be able to introduce her daddy to anyone. So she followed her gut and followed Raylin down the aisle.
Everyone was kind of looking around, like, where did she come from? And she came in right next to Ray, like they'd known each other for so long. There was that connection there.
How could two people bond so quickly?
She helped me feel better.
Raylin says it should be no mystery.
By her kindness.
Recently, Raylin and Emily got together again and now plan to stay friends forever.
Sweet.
Of course, no one will ever replace her dad. But Raylin is clearly on the path to a better place.
Yes.
Thanks to the kindness of a stranger.
Oh, those are good kisses.
And the healing power of a warm puppy.
I'm not crying, Dave Ross. You're crying.
Oh, well. Yeah, that happens sometimes with these stories. Now from G and Ursula Show, which starts at 9 on Cairo Radio. Here's G. Scott. Those of us who watched the attack on the Capitol live as it happened January 6th, only got part of the story, as it turns out, and the rest is now coming from Capitol and D.C. police officers who are testifying now in Congress, using the term terrorists, by the way, to refer to the rioters. From Officer Daniel Hodges, the strongest emotion was confusion.
One man tried and failed to build rapport with me, shouting, "Are you my brother?" Another takes a different tack, shouting, "You will die on your knees."
I know you're watching some of this, G. What do you think the effect of this is going to be?
Powerful. Powerful. I have been glued to the television set. And yes, we watched what happened at the Capitol building that day on January 6th. But to hear the details, to hear it from law enforcement, okay, to hear it from their angle, to hear the things that were said to them, powerful. You can't hide from this. And this is not an attack on any political party, on what I'm going to say. It should be very clear that all of us should want to get to the bottom of what happened that day so that this never happens again. And I would assume that this is a time to put country before party. The testimony has been chilling. I got to tell you, I watched it thinking, okay, let me learn. I'll probably learn something new. And I've just been blown away. Here's a couple of the things. Officer Daniel Hodges, some of the things that he's talking about, by the way, under oath and repeating what was said to him. Quote, here's one. Some of the insurrectionists saying, "Do not attack us. We aren't Black Lives Matter." There was one. And Officer Daniel Hodges also goes on to say that these terrorists attacked him. He perceived them to be Christians, and because they waved Christian flags along with Trump flags and American flags, to him it was devastating. And he also, Sergeant Aquilino, who was one of the first officers to testify this morning, said he was more afraid that day on January 6th than he ever was when he was deployed in Iraq. So, again, there will be a lot of testimony. This is an opportunity for us to get to the bottom of things. And, I this just wasn't an attack on the Capitol. And if there's one thing you start to make clear, like, yeah, the Capitol building, sure, that's where that happened. But this was an attack on Congress. Right. This was attack because people were incited to go that day to, if you will, attack a group of people that were performing their constitutional duty. That is an outrageous crime. And it's not just the people that were there that day. And they're grown adults for them to do that day. But there's also some responsibility, we're going to find out, from those higher up that help incite that deal. Because that was a scary situation. And I guess what I'm saying is even though I've seen the video, you've seen the video.
Yeah.
Having it play out right now under oath, the testimony, it makes it a different ball game.
Yeah, well, this is what makes it different. I keep hearing the comparison. Why don't you do a similar investigation of the riots in various cities? This was an attempt to prevent a Congress from counting my vote, your vote, everybody's vote. That's what this was about. And there were definite death threats made, and that's what these officers are are talking to right now, holding the line because they're worried that people are going to get lynched. That was the word that one of them used in his testimony this morning. And we have, I think we have, here's another clip from what Daniel Hodges said.
It was clear the terrorists perceived themselves to be Christians. I saw the Christian flag directly to my front. Another read, Jesus is my savior, Trump is my president. Another, Jesus is king. One flag read, don't give up the ship. Another had crossed rifles beneath the skull, emblazoned with the pattern of the American flag. To my perpetual confusion, I saw the thin blue line flag, a symbol of support for law enforcement, more than once being carried by the terrorists as they ignored our commands and continued to assault us.
So let me ask you this. I'm going to ask David Fahrenthold next hour, too. Yeah. Given that the House Speaker rejected the Republicans that Kevin McCarthy wanted appointed, I mean, they've got Liz Cheney and they've got Adam Kinzinger. Do you think the report of this committee is going to have any credibility with Republicans?
I think it'll have credibility with Republicans off the record, not on the record, because for some reason, and I don't know what it is, I don't know what Donald Trump does to some of these folks, but there is this fear. I would have never thought that even after January 6th, we would have a problem with people wanting to get to the bottom and an understanding of what happened. So the answer to your question, no, I do think that there will be the same folks that publicly did not want this investigation, will publicly call this a sham, and I don't think there will be any change because of fear of that man. Hmm. That's the only way I can get to it.
Yeah. G. Scott joins Ursula at 9 o'clock on Cairo Radio. G., thank you. And on Tuesdays, we take you live to the nation's capital and Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter David Fahrenthold at the Washington Post. I've been watching some of the testimony this morning from the Capitol police officers. It is pretty intense, but there are only two Republicans on this select committee, David. They are both not friends of Trump. Nancy Pelosi, as I guess most people know, rejected the pro-Trump members that were recommended by the House Minority Leader. So will this committee's report have any credibility among Republicans?
Well, among Trump's hardest core supporters, probably not. But I think what matters out of this committee, or what will matter, is not what the lawmakers say. It's not what the report they write. It's what people see of this testimony, what they see these officers saying and the other witnesses saying. And so from that point of view, I think the Democrats are fine with this setup. If there's no Jim Jordan or no other Republicans disrupting this committee or making a circus out of it, they're happier that way, because what people want to see is the witnesses, not the members of Congress. So I think the Democrats are probably pretty pleased that it's turned out this way.
Right. But if that's all you get, I mean, you get some drama out of it, but you don't get that connection as to who's responsible for what happened. And I was seeing this morning a piece saying that I think it was quoting Elise Stefanik, who's is from New York, saying that it is actually Nancy Pelosi who should be testifying, because she's the one who knew the cops were shorthanded and she failed to act to get them more support. Basically saying, I guess the rioters may be to blame for their conduct, but it was Nancy Pelosi and her failure to fund the Capitol Police that gave them that free rein.
Well, I mean, I think that there is a lot of blame for the way the Capitol Police handled this, but I don't think it's in the funding. The Capitol Police are extremely well-funded, and people who have never been to the U.S. Capitol can't really imagine how many Capitol cops there are. There's many the Capitol Police, which patrol an area of, like, I don't know, 8 square blocks, have as many police officers as, like, Memphis, the entire city of Memphis. There's many big city police departments. The problem was not a number of officers in the Capitol Police. The problem was that on that day, they didn't know what was coming, or they didn't act like they knew what was coming. Mm-hmm. I don't think you could put that on Nancy Pelosi or anybody else who's a member of Congress. They're not the day-to-day commanders. You put that on the FBI, on the bosses of the Capitol Police, you know, whoever didn't set up 12 rows of fencing outside the U.S. Capitol and instead had one little flimsy fence manned by police who weren't even in riot gear. So, you know, I don't think that criticism carries much weight. And again, I don't think that's the kind of thing that people in the public are going to really notice out of this. People in Washington get so wrapped up in, is it bipartisan or not? Yeah. What does the official report say? what's going to filter out to people is our little snippets of the testimony, and that probably is more powerful than anything Pelosi or Stefanik could say.
Do you have a sense, now that we've had a lot of perspective on what happened on January 6th, as to whether Trump supporters actually support what happened still?
Well, you know, given my reporting responsibilities, I don't talk to that many Trump supporters. And you do see polls of people. I think it's more that Trump supporters blame other people. They don't blame themselves. They blame Antifa or, you know, people who were not there. They have conspiracy theories about who did it. But I don't think there are that many people out there who are saying that was good. I'm glad they did that. I hope not, at least. I don't think that's a prevalent view, even among Republicans.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's get to your beat, which is Trump's finances and the status of his businesses. I still get text messages from Trump every day, basically asking for money. Eric wants me to send money. Don Jr. wants me to send. They're very disappointed that my name is not on the donor list yet, et cetera, et cetera. He's clearly raking it in and going to be using it to endorse various candidates, I guess, including candidates in the 6th District in your home state where there's a Republican runoff going on. Do you have a sense of how much power he has here and how he intends to use it in the next 3 years?
Well, I think we're in a really interesting moment of Trump's political power because he's raised a ton of money. But as my colleagues have reported, he hasn't actually done that much with it. He certainly hasn't contested any elections, which is what he said he was raising the money for. He hasn't spent any of it on, you know, contesting the 2020 elections, mostly just sitting on it, using it to pay some personal expenses and expending a little bit of it in this race in Texas where it's a Republican versus Republican runoff. Trump has endorsed one. A lot of people in Texas have endorsed the other. And I think people are seeing this perhaps as a test of his, you know, if Trump's candidate loses, it's a little bit of a test of, you know, whether he is the only kingmaker in the Republican Party. Another test, which we won't see the result of until next year, is the Texas race for attorney general, where if you remember, George P. Bush, the son of Jeb Bush, is a Texas statewide official, the land commissioner there. And he has run against Ken Paxton, who's a sitting attorney general. He's under indictment for securities fraud. He brought that crazy election suit where he asked the Supreme Court to overturn the election in 2020. George P. Bush has sucked up to Trump for years and has, you know, sought Trump's endorsement. Trump endorsed his opponent yesterday. And so we'll see in 2022 whether, you know, the Bush name or the Trump name matters more in Texas, in the Republican circles, at least.
Yeah. Is anybody yet taking Trump versus Biden polls?
Yes. Some poor souls are, and Biden always wins. Biden wins by a lot. I mean,
really?
And Biden, I think the numbers I've seen is 9 to 12 points.
And this is just like a straight head-to-head race, huh?
Yeah, I mean, there's any presidential polls this many years out. I don't think it's hard to put a lot of stock in that. But I don't think Trump, you know, Trump has always benefited in his life from novelty. Right? He does best when you've never really seen him work, when you've heard his reputation and you hear his promises, but you haven't seen him work. The second bite at the apple, Trump is not so great. Think about, you know, his bankruptcy in New York real estate, his failures in Atlantic City, you know, the third and fourth seasons of The Apprentice. He doesn't do well in the second go-round. I think he's going to run into that problem here if he tries to run again.
What do you expect to come from the courts in terms of the investigations into his empire? Is there anything about to break, or is that still going to be – we're still talking long-term for that?
We're working on that, trying to figure out what's next. Are they looking at Trump's kids? Are they looking at Trump himself? You know, has Alan Weisselberg turned? Nothing has happened since the big indictments we talked about at the beginning of this month of Alan Weisselberg and two Trump org entities. I don't think that investigation is over, but at this point, I don't have a great sense of what is coming next. It's possible there could be more indictments even as soon as next month. You know, or maybe this is the end. We're struggling to figure that out right now.
Okay. Well, it sounds like it's still up in the air. Well, infrastructure. Are they going to get their bipartisan deal, or is that dead? They keep pushing the deadline.
They keep pushing it. I have to think it's going to happen just because there's so much incentive. Like, you know, it's a deal to spend a whole bunch of money, you know, and then in ways that your constituents will notice. So I have to think they're going to work it out eventually. But I don't know. I mean, these deals in Congress always seem dead until they come back to life and they're approved. So everybody seems to want it, including the business community, and all these Republican senators could benefit from it. So if I had to lay money, I would say it's going to happen.
David Farenthold, live from The Washington Post. David, thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.